Welcome to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Driven to Business is a business forum program that focuses on success principles in business. And now, it's time for Driven to Business.
Hello, welcome to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. Glad you're here. We're going to talk today a little bit about motivating employees or motivating your team members. How often have you ever walked into a place and the people behind the counter became immediately apparent to you that they didn't like their jobs, didn't want to be there, and were not interested in talking to you? You know, they're standing around talking among themselves or on the phone with somebody or basically ignoring you completely. And you remember how annoyed you were, no matter what kind of business that was, how annoying that is to you and how disgusting it is to you. And it really gives you a bad impression of the business. Well, guess what? You need to be very certain as a leader in a business that your business is not projecting that image to people. And perhaps you're not a walk-in business. A lot of businesses are not, unless you're retail. But maybe when somebody calls or when somebody writes you or visits your webpage or sends you a tweet or a text or something, how do you respond to it? How is it responded to? Are people ignored or are they dealt with in a forthright and enthusiastic manner? It all has to do with employee motivation. Zig Ziglar, I've quoted this a number of times, but I love it. He says, you know, you don't build a business, you build people, and they build a business. We've talked here before about the idea of, you know, there are plenty of one-man show operations that are very, very successful, or maybe a husband-wife operation. There are those kind of businesses around. They do very well. And when you're, if you're just deciding you're going to start a business, that's something you're going to have to consider. And it is true that when you have employees, you also, you do inherit their problems. There's no question about that. And not to cover that up, there is a joy also, I will say, after many years of it, of having employees and having relationships with them and watching them grow and the business take on a creative flair that that other people besides me have brought into it, and that's something you can look at as well. If you have any kind of a leadership role, you are tasked with getting people to move from one place to another. And getting them to do that is called motivation. I was looking at the dictionary prior to walking in today. The definition of motivated is the condition of being eager to work. And, you know, surprising as it may be, you have a lot to do with whether the people at work in your organization under you are even with you. I'll go that far, even with you, perhaps not even under you, work with you, are motivated and eager to get the task done at the organization or not. You know, a lot of us, many times, we talk about, you hear in some literature, you'll hear extrinsic rewards, which are rewards of money and benefits, things of that sort, as opposed to intrinsic rewards in business, which are the rewards of a sense of satisfaction, a sense of well-being, a sense of happiness in the business. You know, my experience has been, and this is well-documented in business literature, money is more often a demotivator over the long haul than it is a motivator. When I was a field service engineer out in Texas, we had a customer out there. This wasn't my company. It was another company I worked for. And this guy was a real piece of work. I'm not going to say his name or the name of the company. I would imagine, just from his personality, he's not alive anymore. I suspect he's had a heart attack or something because he was one of the most stressed out guys I ever met. I never saw him. His face wasn't red and angry and yelling at somebody. And his making a service call in his facility was an experience. In fact, it's a little bit of an aside, but, you know, we ended up, this is a customer that the business I was with, then we ended up firing this customer. We decided he was more trouble to deal with than he was worth. You know, you never hear of that, do you? You hear of customers firing vendors. But, you know, it does happen when a customer is just so much trouble, you don't want to deal with them. I remember as a service manager there, it got down to where I had guys telling me they would quit before they would go out there. And so, you know, when you get to that point, like, you just can't go out there anymore. And, of course, he argued about every nickel and dime that we charged and it just made life miserable there. But what I used to observe going there was his employees, and I used to wonder how anybody would work there. Well, this was in Houston, Texas, at a time when the economy was booming out there, and there were jobs all over the place, and anybody could work anywhere. And while they were working for him, he would demean them in front of anybody and demean them in front of me. If a machine broke down, if the guy running the machine even made the slightest attempt to get that machine running again, like, you know, maybe it was something obvious, he would just be screamed at and ridiculed for doing it. And so consequently, the result of that was that when something broke out there, everybody just stood there and did nothing. And his employees are all downcast, downtrodden. And, you know, many of them, it turns out he was actually paying them a lot of money. And one of them told me, he said, I'm kind of trapped in this job because it said it pays so much I can't leave it, but I hate it. How would you like to have employees that's what you're having to do? You're paying them so much they don't want to leave, and you're having to do that because otherwise they would be leaving, and you're paying them an exorbitant amount. Yet at the same time, you're getting very poor production out of them because they can't stand being there. They are watching the clock. The second it's time to go home, they are out of there like a bullet. They're not going to do one extra thing there. Like I said already, the guy would ridicule them for even attempting to do anything. Now, that's the worst example I've ever seen personally of that. You read about other things. But the whole idea is that if you're going to motivate employees and deal with employees, you had better, you need, no one wants employees like that. There's a gentleman who wrote a book many years ago called The Flight of the Buffalo. And what he talked about in there was that, you know, the old buffalo hunters, the way they would kill a herd of buffalo, they would shoot the head bull, and then the rest of the herd would just stand around. They'd pick them off one by one. Well, think of your place of business where you have a leadership role. When you're not there, what are they doing? Well, if you're the kind of a employer or a leader there where people are scared to death to make any moves without you being there, well, guess what? They're not going to make any moves without you being there. They're just going to stand around. Is that really, is that beneficial to your operation to have people when you're not there standing around and afraid to do anything at all? Nope. You know what? You need to have a work atmosphere where people are not afraid to make mistakes, and they're not afraid, not that they don't want to make mistakes, but you understand that mistakes are made. I make them, you make them, everybody makes them. The trick from a mistake is to learn from it. John Maxwell talks about it, wrote a book called Failing Forward, the idea that when you fail, fall forward. Learn something from that and get back up and go on. You know, the idea that if you read stories, the success stories of many, many people in business, what you'll find is that they almost all had some sort of a major failure in their life. You know, when I worked for this company in Texas, the idea of intrinsic versus extrinsic rewards, in other words, the idea of money can be a demotivator. When I was promoted to a position there to move back to Houston, they asked me what I wanted for salary. I've never been asked that before. And I gave them what I thought was a pretty good figure. And they said, okay. And I went out there, and I was very happy with that salary. In fact, I would go so far as to say I was kind of proud of it. It was making pretty good money. And I was very proud of it and very happy to be working there and just, you know, things going really well. Then one day, I happened to see a piece of paper that I shouldn't have seen, actually, but it ended up across my desk. And I saw that another person in a sort of an equal position with me was making more money than I was making. And I got very depressed about it. And I almost went home and had I went home and had a bit of a talk with myself about that because I was almost shocked at how depressed I got over that. And I began to ask myself, you know, was there anything different yesterday than today about your pay? And the answer is no. Did they cut your pay? No. Have they mistreated you in any way? No. Didn't they pay what you asked them to pay you? Yes. I mean, so why are you now mad at this company? Well, it's because we all have that. That's a little bit of a built-in thing. It's because money can be a demotivator. And, you know, anything that you do for an extrinsic reward to somebody, here's what happens to it. And we're all like this. This is not knocking anybody. We're all like this, whether you're talking about children or employees or ourselves. Things that we are given, extrinsic rewards like money or anything you name, but just stay with money for a minute, like money, it very quickly becomes an entitlement. very quickly becomes an entitlement to us. And then if it's not there, although it was intended as an incentive and a reward, the moment that's taken away from us, it's not like we view it, well, I was lucky to get that for a couple of years. That's not how you think about it. You're mad because it's been taken away from you, because what is a reward like that becomes an entitlement very soon. You know, in my pay situation, I was really proud and happy about my salary until I saw what somebody else was making. And why? Well, you know, as a Christian, I can say it's sin in my life. It's certainly pride in my life, and perhaps jealousy and some other things that were perhaps more strong in me than I thought they were. But nonetheless, I had to really have a serious conversation with myself and really upbraid myself about it. And I got over it. I did manage to get over it and become happy about it again. But I did learn a lesson from that, because that's exactly how, when you're dealing with anybody and you're dealing with money, that's why these extrinsic rewards like money can be a problem. As the show goes on, we're going to talk about that. There's a couple of great articles, one of them from the Harvard Business Review and one of them out of the Wall Street Journal that I want, and Forbes magazine I want to talk to, that actually deals with the science of that. And it's very interesting to deal with that. You know, you would think that it just goes without saying that you reward more of the behavior you want and you punish the behavior you don't want. And to some level, that's true. You know, we've seen this with children. You know, you tell a child, you know, if you do this, I'm going to have to, you know, you're going to be punished for this. You're going to be rewarded for this. And so the idea is they tend to toe that line. Here's the problem with that, and I'll just a little preview. We'll read through this in a minute. One of the problems with it is that tends to become a means unto itself. It becomes, you do just enough to avoid the punishment and just enough to get the reward. You know, if you're telling your kid, if you take out, I'm going to give you $10 for taking out the garbage, when he was kind of taking it out before without being paid. Well, here's what happens the first time you say, you know, I'm only going to pay $5, and the kid's going to refuse to take the garbage out. That's where you're going to be with that, because we're all like that. That's why those kinds of things don't work. We're talking about motivating employees, by the way, streaming live on biz1190.com, podcast on eddiemayfield.com, and on iTunes. I am Eddie Mayfield. This is Driven to Business. Back in a minute. Welcome back to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're glad that you're here. We're talking about employee motivation. And again, let me say, you can be a motivator in the company, whether or not you are the owner of the company, whether or not you even have a titled leadership position. You know, in today's workplace, there's less and less titles around. It's more of an egalitarian type workplace where people have jobs to do and they're not titled. You can still exercise great leadership skills, and in fact, great leadership skills in a situation like that. And one of the leadership skills is in motivating others to do their best. So that's a great skill and trait to learn for your own career advancement and for the advancement of your organization, whatever that may be. Back in the Harvard Business Review, back in the July-August edition of 2008, had an article called Employee Motivation, a Powerful New Model, and it was a compilation of a lot of research that was done. And let me give I'll summarize some of it for you, and you can agree or disagree with some of it. But you know, they said that people basically, they were talking about employees in particular, that employees basically have four drivers in their lives. One of them is a drive to acquire. I'll talk about that a little more. That's we're acquiring scarce goods or even intangible things such as social status. That's a driver. The other is the drive to bond. That's to form meaningful connections with individuals and groups. The drive to comprehend. That's to satisfy curiosity and sort of master the world around us. And the drive to defend. That's to protect against external threats and promote justice. When you begin talking about those things, you begin to find out that these really do have some effects. I want to go over a little bit of them with you. Again, the four drives are drive to acquire, drive to bond, drive to comprehend, drive to defend. The drive to acquire. We are all in some ways driven to acquire scarce goods that kind of bolster our sense of well-being. And again, we experience some delights. Excuse me. we experience some delight when this drive is fulfilled, and we have some discontentment when it's not fulfilled. And this phenomenon doesn't only apply to physical goods, like food, clothes, new car, so forth, but also to experiences like travel, entertainment, and not to mention events that improve our social status, such as being promoted or getting an office, having a title, things of that sort. And this drive tends to be relative. Basically, we always compare what we have with what others possess. Remember my story about the pay? That's exactly what the deal is here. We tend to compare what we have with what others possess. And this drive is, for most of us, insatiable. We always want more. You know, that's the old joke about how much money is enough. It's always a little more than I've got. That's how much money is enough. And if you talk to some of the richest people in the world, they're still driven to get to get more. There was a gentleman I heard. I happened to be in a meeting where some big landowners were in there, and they were all kidding. This guy was the biggest landowner in the state. One of them in there, and the other fellows in there were kidding him, saying, "Man, how much is enough land?" And he made sort of a joke about it. And he said, "I have very simple wants." He said, "All I want is the land that adjoins mine. That's all I ever want." And you know, of course, again, that never ends. The other drive is the drive to bond. All of us human beings want to be part of something larger than ourselves. You know, it started with me as a young man, even back when I was in the U.S. Coast Guard. The idea that the Coast Guard, we were rescuing people, we were saving lives. And I had a very small part of that. But it gives you a great sense of well-being to think that you are part of that, that you're part of something larger than yourself. You're part of something more important than yourself. And that's a big, big driver. For those of us that are Christians, that's a driver there for us, and something for us, the idea that we're part of a kingdom that's much larger than ourselves. This drive, when met, the drive to bond, when met, is very associated with very strong positive emotions like love and caring. And when we don't get it, we see depression and loneliness. That's also why employees become much more motivated and much more productive when they are proud of belonging to your organization. And their loss of morale when that institution betrays them. I knew some guys years ago that were employed by a large corporation right here in Atlanta with whom they had actually interned there when they were in college. They went to work there directly out of college. They worked there about 25 years. And then it was a big merger and reorganization of that company. And they were let go. And I was over at one of them's house. This is a grown man who was crying. He wasn't, and they gave him a fairly good severance package. That wasn't it. But he was so emotionally torn that this company with whom he had been loyal all these years was disloyal to him. And that's what that bond thing is, a very strong drive, the idea of bond. And again, this is why the idea that is people being proud and feeling belonging to your organization, that is why it's very important that your organization grow. You know, you hear the thing all the time that organizations either grow or go backwards, they don't stand still. Well, that's generally true, but the reason for it, it doesn't have anything, it has to do, it's an emotional reason as much as anything else. People that are employed by growing organizations tend to stay motivated and tend to stay with that organization. Once people feel that an organization is failing, that it has no future, your best people start bailing, and that has a negative effect, and it increases your slide down the hill. That's just what happens. It's an emotional thing. Again, the drive to bond, the drive to comprehend. All of us want to make some sense of the world around us. We want to sort of produce little theories and that make things comprehensible. And we want, and by seeing them as comprehensible, then we sort of figure out reasonable and intelligent actions and responses. And we all get very frustrated when things seem senseless, which is why most of us get so annoyed at things like the government. You know, you go to a government and it's like, this makes no sense whatsoever that I'm standing in a line here when you could do this on a computer. I mean, that's the kind of thing that drives people nuts. And again, it has to do with drive to comprehend. You don't like seeing things around you that make no sense whatsoever, and you have no control over. You can't produce any theory how to get around this. And it's very frustrating. Employees are very motivated by jobs that challenge them and enable them to learn and grow, and they're demoralized, very demoralized, by jobs that they perceive to be a dead end. And again, the trick is that they perceive. And, you know, part of your job, perhaps you've got somebody doing a job and they don't see how important that job is. It's a very, very important job. It may be your job as a leader to explain carefully to them where their job fits into everything and why their job is absolutely essential. They will feel better about that job. And I'm not suggesting you go in and fake it either. Don't go in there and make up something that's not true. But, you know, in the first place, in your organization, you shouldn't have anybody employed that's not doing a valuable job. If they're not doing a valuable job, then, the question is, why do you have them there? I'm like that. When we've been asked before for, like, some guy want to take a 6-month sabbatical. I'm like, if I could do without you 6 months, I don't need that position, and so we're not going to have that position. I mean, that's so there should be no jobs in your organization that are not worthwhile. But it may be your job as a leader to go in and explain to that individual why, because don't assume that person understands, because perhaps you've not done a very good job and your culture there has not done a good job of making that person feel needed and valuable by explaining to them how important that job is. You know, talented employees who feel trapped in a job will most often leave those companies. You know, headhunters, people that are out hunting for talented people, they look very carefully at companies that are in the midst of turmoil or mergers and things like that, because they figure there's going to be some dissatisfied people there, and it makes them prime picking. So be sure in your company that you're ready for that. That if things are changing in your company, and you know, if things don't always go well in a company, we all know that. As a leader, it's your job to keep motivating, keep spirits high in there, make people feel a part, let them be part of it. Or we'll one more drive to talk about, and we'll do it after the break. It's called The Drive to Defend. We'll talk about that. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. We're here every Saturday, and I'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back. You're listening to Driven to Business. I'm Eddie Mayfield. As always, glad you're here. We're here every Saturday morning right here on Atlanta's Business Radio, Biz 1190 at 11 a.m. Today's program will be podcast on eddiemayfield.com and on iTunes. You can always find podcasts of past programs on there. You can email me at eddie@eddiemayfield.com. That's E-D-D-I-E, mayfield.com. Program is sponsored by our company EMA, and that's EMAINC.net. We've been talking about these drivers that people have, and you know, we talk about the drive to acquire, the drive to bond, the drive to comprehend, and we're going to talk then about the drive to defend. We all naturally defend ourselves, and we defend our property and our accomplishments. We defend our family and our friends, and we defend our ideas and beliefs against threat. It's not only it does not only manifest itself in aggressive behavior, but also as a quest to create institutions that promote justice. And we like the idea that people should be able to express their ideas and opinions. And fulfilling this drive to defend leads to feelings of security and confidence, and not fulfilling that leads to things like fear and resentment. And this is one of the reasons drive to defend is one of the things that tells us a lot about people that are resistant to change. And it's one reason employees can be devastated by the prospect of a merger or an acquisition. You know, the leaders of a company can kind of, well, in many companies will sort of keep that quiet for obvious reasons, and then they kind of spring it on employees, and many of them are amazed at how demoralized the employees are, even when it appears it is the best for the organization, and they would, on an empirical level, agree with that. But people don't like change like that because there's a fear of it. There's a fear to defend what you've got. You know, maybe today you're the top performer in the company, and they're merging with another company, and there's going to be some people there doing the same thing you're doing, and all of a sudden you're concerned about that you're going to have to defend your performance and your contributions there. And again, this is why headhunters do target companies in the middle of mergers, because they know people feel vulnerable. And they sometimes feel they're at the mercy of managers that are making arbitrary decisions. And that plays into several of the drives, the Comprehend drive and some others. Here's the thing that these researchers that wrote this article in the Harvard Business Review said this interesting about this. They said that each of these four drives, all four of them, the drive to acquire, the drive to bomb, the drive to comprehend, and the drive to defend, they're all independent. And they can't be ordered in any kind of a hierarchy. In other words, one's not important than the other, and they can't be substituted. In other words, you can't just pay your employees a lot of money and hope they'll feel enthusiastic about their work. Back to my example of the man in Texas that berated his employees in front of everybody but paid them a lot. They were not enthusiastic about their work because although he worked on the drive to acquire, he killed the drive to bond and the drive to comprehend and the drive to defend. He kind of ruined that side of it. And so consequently, they're not happy there. And it's not enough, on the other hand, to help people bond as a close-knit team when they're underpaid or they're working away at just incredibly boring jobs. You can get people to work in situations like that. They might need the money, but you won't get the most out of them. And your risk of losing them altogether is going to happen if somebody comes along and do that. And so to fully motivate your employees, you have to address all four of those drives. One of the most effective ways to do it, and we talk about this at our company all the time, is to engender a culture of camaraderie. Promote teamwork, collaboration, openness, friendship, things of that sort. You know, I talk here a lot of times about the idea that people who are if you want a friendly culture in the hiring process, you need to start by hiring friendly people. And then you need to encourage friendly behavior at work. And you need to strongly discourage unfriendly work to the point of perhaps, I'm not big on just firing somebody because they snap at somebody once. But if it's a continued habit, you're going to have to get somebody to change the way they are there. The idea of making a culture, that's one way to get that kind of thing going. The drive to comprehend, drive to understand, is to design jobs that are meaningful and interesting. You know, no one likes doing what in their view is make work. Nobody likes that. You don't like it. Nobody else likes it. And although the job you're having them do may not be make work, it may look like it because of the way that you assign it or the way that you deal with employee. Well, you need to do a better job about that. If you want to motivate them, let them understand that as meaningful work. And also, you know, we found it's true in our organization that you may sometimes have people in the wrong jobs. They're good people. You just got them doing the wrong job in your organization. That's happened to me a number of times, where you find somebody that's really a talented, smart person, but just not making it in that particular little spot you got them in. But you find out they're really good at something else, and you move them over into that, and all of a sudden they're able to shine. Again, that has to do with job design. All of those are those four drives are, I think, an interesting way of looking at it. Again, let me review with you. It's a drive to acquire. It's a drive to acquire scarce goods or intangible things such as social status. A drive to bond, which is to form connections with individuals and groups. We all want to do that. The drive to comprehend, to satisfy curiosity and kind of master the world around us. And the drive to defend, which is to protect against threats, external threats to us, and to promote justice. We all have that in us. There was another article that I had read recently. It's from the Wall Street Journal, again, back in 2009, written by a guy named, actually, I don't have the author in front of me here. I printed out, sorry, did not write the author out. It has a title of Motivating Employees, and it starts off asking a question. Is it why do people work? And I think if any of us ask one another that, we without thinking, we'd probably say, because they have to, or for the money, I owe, so off to work I go, and people do work for those, you can't get around that. But the fact of the matter is we all know people and perhaps you are one yourself, we all know people who pour themselves into work for which they're not really getting paid very much. I'm very active in church, and I can tell you, there are people that put a lot of time into church, and they're not being paid a dime for that. A lot of work. And so consequently, that's not all it is. That's not the only reason that people work. Some years ago, there was a guy from MIT named Douglas McGregor. He was studying this, this was 1960, keep in mind. And he came up with some assumptions that he said most people in management and business had. Let me just read them to you, what he said. Here's the assumption. Humans dislike work and will avoid it if possible. And because of that, they must be coerced, controlled, directed, or threatened with punishment to force them to put forth adequate effort. The average person wishes to be directed, wishes to avoid responsibility, has little ambition, and wants security above all. Now, let me ask you, if you're in a leadership position, work, do you believe that about people? Do you believe that people dislike work and will avoid it if at all possible? And because of that, the only way you get them to work is coerce them, control them, direct them, or threaten them to get them to put forth an adequate effort to keep things going. And that the average person actually likes being directed and does not want responsibility, has very little ambition, and wants security above all. Well, turns out the research indicates that's actually not true at all of the population. And McGregor found that out. And here's what he found, is that work for human beings is as natural as play or rest. People will, on their own, exercise self-direction and self-control in the service of objectives to which they are committed. And that's a big thing there, if they're committed. The average human learns under proper conditions to not only accept but to seek responsibility. And a high degree of imagination, ingenuity, and creativity is widely distributed, in other words, it's common in the population. And modern industrial life, and he was talking about in the 60s, under the 1960s version of management, our vision of management, the intellectual abilities of the average person are underutilized. Now, what happened was that McGregor's findings became the baseline for management theory for the next decades and up to now. The idea that people will, in fact, work on their own if they're motivated, and they will almost manage themselves if they're motivated to do things. The goal of management then becomes, or leadership simply becomes, not to direct and control employees that are seeking to get out of work, but rather to create conditions where people want to offer maximum effort. That's the idea of as a leader, you go in and say, how can I help you be successful here? That's an approach of a leader to take for motivating employees. How can I help you be more successful here? And, another thing that happened to me a number of years ago at another company was that I was over a number of offices and service centers, and my best manager quit to move away. And I tried my best to keep him there. I was so upset and depressed about it. I thought there was no one else was going to be able to take his place, and that facility that he was managing was going to just go in the toilet because of it. But you know what? There was a young tech working back there. A young guy named Ernie had always been a pretty good tech, but I never had thought of him as being kind of a leader. But when we really needed him, and offered him the chance to accept responsibility, he stepped up and it turned out, after the other very good leader had left there, the other service manager left there, that due to this other young man's stepping up and taking the position and growing into it very quickly, stepping up and just absolutely taking responsibility, taking on the challenge and doing it, it was actually better than it was before the other guy left. I never would have known that, but it's a great lesson to learn in life. Sometimes you may have some people working for you or working with you that really are just waiting for an opportunity to shine, and perhaps the reason they have it is you haven't given them the opportunity. That's always a trick of us in leadership, isn't it? To be sure that we're giving people the not only the tools and the opportunity, but recognizing and giving them a chance to step up and shine up to their highest potential. One more segment to come. You're listening to Eddie Mayfield. This is Driven to Business. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to the final segment of today's Driven to Business. We're talking about motivating employees or coworkers in your place of business or organization and how it's important. We started off by talking about what it's like to go in a place with demotivated employees. You've all done it. I don't have to spend any time on that at all. You've all done it. You know exactly what that looks like. You see it instantly. And the trick is to be sure your place is not that way. Also, there's almost an ethical responsibility if you're a leader in a business to be sure that the people that are working there are as happy as they can be in their job. Now, perhaps, this is not to say that you don't have someone working there who just lacks the basic skills to do what needs to be done, and it was a hiring mistake to hire them. That happens. We've done programs before on how you deal with that, and one thing is be sure you're giving good and honest feedback to people and tell them what to do. But for the most part, most of the time, it's a matter of motivation. And, when things are not going well in the company and you're the leader, guess whose fault that is? It's yours. It's not anybody else's. You need to you deal with. All of us have dealt with people who are really great in their jobs, and we've all dealt with people who couldn't care less. And part of the idea is that you want your employees to feel a sense of ownership, and some interesting research on that on some people that tried to do some employee stock option plans and so forth over the years, and they found out that really didn't do it. What they found out actually was that this idea, the feeling of ownership for most people mattered more than actual ownership. You could give a guy a piece of the company and you give him a few shares of stock, but he doesn't see the big picture, so he's not motivated at all by that because he doesn't really see how he's gaining. But however, if you can imbue him with a sense that what you do here is important, and what you do here makes a big difference in the way things are run around here. Well, that's a sort of a psychological ownership. It's defined as the extent to which an employee feels as the organization or the job is theirs. Basically, this is my company. If you can get your employees to say, this is my company, you've gone a long ways. So there's a great article that was written, it was in Forbes magazine by a guy named Robert Bullock a few years ago. And he talked about that quite a bit, the idea of it. And he had some ideas about this. He talked about that here's how you get people to do that. One of them is that you need to be sure that that the employee has as much as possible autonomy. And that means the extent to which employees can use their own judgment in making decisions and carrying out their work. And coupled with that, just as important, is what he called task identity. It's the extent to which a job allows someone to be involved from the beginning of the end of the project. And we had to learn this ourselves. We have some inside salespeople, but one of the problems we found was that the inside salesperson who we were asking to uncover leads, which we would then pass on to an outside type sales type, well, that worked. But here was the problem. The person inside never saw the results of their work. They would give it to somebody else, and they really heard very little about it. Well, that's that task identity. People need to see what the job looks like, the entire job, not just their little myopic view of it. They need to see like what it looks like when the entire thing is done. It'd be like you were building a car and your job was to install the glove box. And all you did all day was just stare at glove boxes and put them in. If you never had any idea what this is going to look like in the end product, what that glove box is going to look like when that beautiful car rolls off the finish line, just the idea that you know what that looks like. It has a lot to do with your job satisfaction and putting that glove box in right and being sure it's exactly installed. Because you want it to be part of the whole when it comes out and look, so it's something you can be proud of. Well, be sure that your folks understand the task identity. Also, this idea of autonomy. You cannot, if you want to employ robots, well, if you micromanage everything they do, that's what you're going to happen because creative, smart people are going to leave. That's what's going to happen. They're going to leave and you're going to be stuck with robots. Well, do you want a company out of robots where you have to make all the decisions, do all the thinking? Is that what you want? Well, if you do, treat people like that. Those things turn out that in all the studies done, that those have enormous payouts for companies. Now, how do you get to do that? Here's how you can increase autonomy a little bit. There's something to do. Involve your staff in making decisions that influence their work. Don't just go in your office and come out with a position paper out of your computer. Go talk to people about it first. or at the very least, put an outline and give it to everybody. And instead of saying, this is how it is, say, what do you think about this? Number one, you're not infallible, and they may have good to do with it. You know, I've heard people say before that what a little word that most people with strong leadership skills just hate is called process. Going through a process, it slows me down. Yeah, it does. And it's essential. You need to be slowed down. So let people do that. Encourage your staff to apply their own judgments when solving problems. And avoid reading people the rules. Avoid management practices and processes that constrain the autonomy, such as, you find some places that are absurd. You can't call a meeting without five managers signing off on it. Well, that's absurd. I mean, let people assume people are intelligent, that intelligence and creativity is widely disseminated, as the research indicates it is, through the population, and let them use that. It'll be to your benefit. On the task identity, in other words, seeing things all the way through, if possible, let them be involved in more than just one area of the work. In other words, if you've got an inside salesperson who's doing inside sales all the time, once in a while, let them go out in the field and see what the other side of that looks like. Continuously, as best you can, communicate how that employee's activities contribute to the whole, where they can see it. And whenever you can, provide employees the opportunity to completely finish any work they start. Now, it may not be possible in every situation, but as much as you can, do that. Because that gives a feeling of accomplishment, a way to see my part in doing this mattered. I wasn't some cog in a wheel somewhere. My part in this really mattered. You know, the fact that I took this thing from beginning to end is a great sense of accomplishment for people. It's how to have widely motivated employees. Now, Bullock also talks about, he says, don't be quite so quick to remove employees that seem to have low positives in this regard, in other words, they seem to have perhaps a bad attitude, because the research shows that the design of the work, by giving even a person with a bad attitude more autonomy and more task identity, in other words, letting them direct their work a little bit and letting them see the finished result of their work, Even that person, it tends to raise their attitude. It tends to make them a much more contributing part of what you do there. You know, we've tried at our company, we've tried to apply some of these standards to and sometimes successfully. Frankly, sometimes nothing works out exactly like you plan to. But we have learned over the years, even like setting up sales plans and so forth, you had really better take all this into account. Again, to go back over what was most of the time on today, this Harvard Business Review from 2008 about employee motivation, they talked about the four drives. Just think about these a little bit. The drive, everybody has these, a drive to acquire, the drive to bond, drive to comprehend, and the drive to defend. If you can let your employees put a business place, put procedures, practices, and your own personal involvement into areas that allow people to satisfy those drives, you're going to have much more motivated employees. And motivated employees to you, how crassly commercial you want to get about it, motivated employees to you are a good way to make more for the organization to be more successful, make more money, and make everyone there, including you, a lot happier with a job that everyone's doing. And we were talking here before about, isn't it a lot better to work in a place where people like to come there? Well, you know what else? It's also really good for your customers to enjoy doing business with a place where people like to be there. They would much rather do business with that than with a place where it's quite obvious people do not want to be there. You've been listening to Driven to Business. By the way, we're here every Saturday morning at 11 o'clock right here on Biz 1190. By the way, if you would like to be on the program, if you're a business leader and you'd like to be on the program, you can contact me at eddie@eddiemayfield.com or contact the station, biz1190.com, or contact me via work. It's eddie@eddiemayfield.com is my email address. We'll be here again next week. This is Driven to Business. See ya.
You've been listening to Driven to Business with your host, Eddie Mayfield. Visit next Saturday at 11 a.m. on Biz 1190 for more Driven to Business. To learn more about Driven to Business, visit eddiemayfield.com or call 770-448-4644.